Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 28th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Daniel Huff. Today's session number is 2003, and it's titled Global Warming 101, A Primer in Climate Change. Let's listen in.
Huff, and this session is entitled Global Warming 101, A Primer in Climate Change. Give you a little idea of my background. Graduated with a degree in biology from University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and have taught high school for 5 years, biology and environmental science and chemistry and anatomy and various science topics. And global warming is always something that I would plug into my classes, regardless of which class it was, just take that aspect of it. Because I think it's something that's important and something that is definitely in the news today and is a good look at science, since it is controversial, and all science is by nature and should be controversial. So what I thought we would do today is, now I am not an expert at all. So I thought we would have time to share about all of our perspectives on global warming, what we know, and I would just talk about some of the backgrounds of the theory and just get an introduction to it, what we can do in just an hour session. So what I thought we would do, here's kind of my outline, kind of talk about what we all know about it. Then I'm going to talk some basic theory and talk about the three planets here, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and how they relate, and looking at how global warming affects those. Talk about some of the controversy over it. What is the evidence, and then what are the predictions? What are the implications for global warming? So, why don't we go around the room? We're a nice small group. Just say our name and what's our, I guess, prior knowledge or interest, or why are you here today for this session?
I'm Scott Slaba, and I'm here. I guess I'm like most of the people I know. Just sort of puzzled by it, disturbed by it, and puzzled by how much of what I hear about global warming is truth and fiction. You know, I see these strange things happening in the Midwest, and I see strange weather patterns in, you know, northern BC and the Yukon, and some, you know, it's easy just to pin it on just global warming. And I just feel there's so much of what is passing off as sort of pseudoscience now. It's just like everything was ADD 5 years ago and corrected with Ritalin. You know, now everything that happens that's weird is global warming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of
puzzling. Yeah. Well, I would agree with your sentiments there.
I'm Carol. And I don't have a lot of scientific knowledge about global warming, but I'm curious about two things. One is, just over the course of my lifetime, I realize and am aware of all of the changes, you know, sort of that reminiscing about when I was little, it used to snow, you know, in the winter kind of thing. I mean, just looking at that now span of time and thinking, you know, what's going on? And also from the political perspective, I'm aware that in the course of my life of awareness that, you know, there was a decade or so when we were concerned about conserving energy, and we were actually talking about, you know, pollution and electric cars, and, you know, and we go through this political upheaval of being concerned about something like global warming, and those of us who took it seriously, I think, kind of feel abandoned in this new century, like, hey, what happened, you know? I thought we weren't going to have big cars anymore. I thought we were all going to, you know, walk. I thought we, you know, and the realization of how politicized things are. So I wonder sometimes when I read about scientific trends, you know, how often I'm just getting fed some political piece of garbage because somebody wants to make more money on this or that. And so I'd like to know more about what hopefully is actually happening so that I can make better judgments how I personally can live more sanely and ecologically on the planet, which I hope will still provide for my children and future generations, and how I can encourage other people to be more responsible I just keep turning off the lights, you know,
driving
my car and thinking that maybe that will help.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, 10 years ago, the best car on the market got about, you know, 50 miles to the gallon, and today the best car on the market gets about 40 or...
Well, and this great curiosity that we run around the Northwest, I mean, my family, including driving off-road vehicles, what is that about?
Yeah. On the road all the time.
Right, on the road, you know.
As Harrison Keillor said, people driving to get their groceries in vehicles they could hunt elephants in.
Exactly.
Yeah. What we respond to, you know, what's being sold to us. So, anyway, it's the ecological concerns that should be driving our choices instead of the what's sold to us.
I agree. What we're doing is just introducing ourselves and telling why we're here and what our perspectives on this hot topic is. You can go last if you want time to think, since everyone else is like that.
Okay. I'm Stephanie, and I really don't know much about green gardening. Just that I come and find out what we can do to help. It seems like you guys were saying, you know, it was a hot topic for a while, and now kind of nobody really cares anymore. And it's kind of discouraging to hear that. And it's also discouraging when you think, I'm just one person, what little can I do when these corporations are out there doing all this damage?
Well, my name is Tom, and I thank you for saying what you did. Because I've reached the age now that I've done enough, been involved enough, that I've become sort of a cynic to the point that I'm retired. And to the point that I really realized that what I did for many years of my life and thought for many years of my life, nobody really gives a shit about. And it made me sort of say, well, what's it all about, Alfie, kind of thing. And I remember having topics on when I did classes and things. It was about the corporate climate and the globalization of corporations and all of these things, and a population control, and why we needed to curb, and what all these things is like, it's non-existent. I know that for me it's true, but look at the room. Who's in here? Is this a packed room? Does anybody care? I also feel like I'm going to be a reincarnated soul. I already know that I've done this before, so I'm not really that concerned about it anymore. So I have my sanity, I have my happiness, and I have my big truck. When 20 years ago I had a Volkswagen, and I wore Birkenstocks. Still wear Birkenstocks. Some things don't change, but it is really interesting. And I get in discussions with people, because I used to work in the political field, and they say, well, you're sort of a cynic. And I says, well, I'm just telling you the realities of what I saw. And that everything's a political decision. It has nothing to do with the reality of the issues, including life or death, health or safety. It's a political decision. It's not a reality. And so I'm sitting in here because I got tired of hiking. I'm just worn out, so I thought I'd sit, enjoy.
And be our resident cynic or realist, as you might say.
You know, I'm the eternal optimist. And I do believe that it will be okay, and it will be fun, but I just don't take it as seriously as I used to. I can't, because otherwise it kills you.
Yeah. I think we do have to find our own peace with it.
Yeah, I just got a peace, you know, it's okay. And if you don't want to do it, that's your business. I just do for me.
Is anybody familiar with Donald Call, the writer? Great Iowa satirist. Once commented that if you're about politics, if you're not a cynic, you just haven't been watching.
Or you haven't been around long enough. Or you just
I suppose you can amend that a number of ways.
Yeah, this is cool. So I can laugh at it. Before I didn't laugh. I'm pretty serious. Now I laugh. Still do my thing.
I'm Laura Huff, and I'm a big fan of the presenter. And you too. To learn from all of you. I don't know a lot about global warming, and I want to know what piece I can do to help halt some of that.
To me?
Sure.
Well, you know, I have a good friend who is a political activist in Seattle, and she has so much information about global warming that she always brings and shares with me, and I thought I really owe it to her and her passion about global warming to be more informed so that I can be better in dialogue with her. Mm. So here I am.
Great.
This is Barbara.
Oh, yes.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
I'm David.
David?
Daniel.
Daniel.
Yeah. Okay. I have a brother, David, so if you call me David, it's okay. It's just with my mom.
Wait, did you ask us why we're here?
Yeah, we're just saying, you know, why you chose this session. What are your perspectives on global warming?
I'm Helen Walsh, and, you know, I know bits and pieces. When it affects me, I hear something, but I need an overview. And I also read that you used to be a high school teacher, so I need somebody that can explain in a way that I can really understand. And I want to be able to talk to my daughter about it. She's 5, and I want to begin to talk in ways of what we can do every day that makes an impact on our world. And so that's, I really want the bigger picture so that every day we can be conscious about little things and how to, you know, send that on to my daughter.
Great. Well, and as I said to earlier, I'm not an expert, so hopefully what I plan to provide is an overview. So I hope it will be helpful. Well, first of all, we're going to talk about Goldilocks and the three planets. Because Goldilocks went to the three planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, and found that Venus was just too dang hot, 430 degrees centigrade, which is, I think, about 700-800 degrees Fahrenheit. So awfully darn hot. And Mars, as we all know, is just too darn cold. So Earth was just right. Why is Earth just right? Well, a lot of factors. And we all think it's the distance from the sun. But that's only part of it. In fact, if Earth was where Venus is, Earth would not be that hot. And if Venus was where we are, Venus would be hotter than we are. So why is that? There's a lot of things that affect a whole planet's climate. And three of the big things are how much sun does it get? And from the sun we get, of course, light. But heat that we get from the sun is not light, it's infrared. If you've ever studied radiation, there are lots of types of radiation going from radio waves on one end to gamma rays on the other. The radio waves that our FM and AM stations are tuned into, and gamma rays that we fight cancer with, or if you're out in space, get them and die without protection. And right in the middle is light, and just below light is infrared, which is heat. And it's called infrared because it's just below red on the visible light spectrum. And so if you go to a fast food place and you see that bright red bulb, that's a heat lamp because it is shifted towards the infrared spectrum, putting out more heat. So one of the things the sun's putting out is a lot of infrared. And as nice rocky planets, there's a lot of substance there to absorb that heat. But that's not the only thing. If that was the only thing we dealt with, Earth would be frozen. Earth would actually be, let's see, if we look just at how much light it gets, it would be right around, probably around zero-ish. It would be between negative 18 degrees centigrade and 6 degrees centigrade.
What's that Fahrenheit, roughly?
That would be 6 degrees is about 40 degrees Fahrenheit, mm-hmm. and negative 18 is probably around 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah. So with zero on the centigrade scale being
freezing cold.
Yeah, of water. So that means that it wouldn't be life on Earth. Well, there's two other things that affect it. One is albedo. And albedo is when you see Earth from space, it shines. You know, there's Earth glow. And the moon has it. We see the moon shine. It has albedo. It's how much is reflected back into space. And that has to do with what is the planet made up of. Ice and snow has a high albedo, high reflection. High clouds have a high albedo, lots of reflection. Dark rock has a very low albedo, so it would absorb most. So of these three planets, Mars has the lowest albedo. So of the sun that hits it, it absorbs most of it. Venus actually has the highest albedo because it's all clouds. You can't see the surface of Venus. It's just really high, thick clouds that reflect actually about 75% of the radiation that hits Venus is reflected. And Earth, let's see, ours is maybe 50%, I think, or a little 40-something percent albedo. And then the other thing are gases that then trap heat. Carbon dioxide is the largest greenhouse gas. And just as you park your car in the parking lot in the summertime and the sunlight comes in, the infrared rays can get in, but when they bounce off of your interior of your car, the wavelength changes. They lose some of their energy to your seats of your car and can't get back out of the glass. So they can get in but can't get out, so then they just keep building up and warming up the interior of your car. Well, greenhouse gases do the same thing. And the most potent greenhouse gases that we are aware of, at least in our atmosphere and Venus's atmosphere, are carbon dioxide, water vapor, and then methane, and then the human-created CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbons. Those are all big greenhouse gases.
So when you say greenhouse gases, what are you referring to, Daniel? I mean, you're saying that they, like, use the car example again.
Okay. So what they do, if we have an atmosphere, mm-hmm. Okay, so here's the gases of the atmosphere that are over the surface of a planet. Okay, here being the surface of the planet.
They're like the windshield then.
They're like the windshield. Now we have gases like nitrogen and oxygen, which are the primary components of our atmosphere, and they perform no greenhouse effect. Any infrared rays that come in would go right out if it was all oxygen and nitrogen. But there are some gases, carbon dioxide being a very potent one. It's right in green here. Carbon dioxide, which is CO2, and that's what we exhale when we breathe, and it's also what, whenever we burn anything, whether it be wood or fossil fuel or whatever, we release carbon dioxide. Then some others, such as methane, CH4, methane. Methane comes from whenever you have bacteria break down something without the presence of oxygen. So in a septic tank, that's methane, because it's no oxygen, anaerobic. In the guts of us, as well as of cows, that's methane that's produced. Rice paddies produce methane because they're stagnant water. Swamps produce, a swamp gas is methane. And it is flammable.
What about composting? Is that methane at all?
It depends on how you do your compost. If you do slow compost, where you don't really turn it, then it will produce some methane. If you turn it regularly, then it becomes aerobic, and it will not produce methane. And you'll find that if you turn your compost, it doesn't smell as bad, and it goes faster. That's because it's aerobic. Just like Jane Fonda, aerobics, you breathe a lot of oxygen. Yeah. So that's the aerobic versus anaerobic. And then water vapor is actually a big greenhouse gas. And we're going to talk about water vapor because water vapor in its different forms can either increase greenhouse effect or decrease, because if it's clouds, it can reflect. So it can have an albedo effect. And then only on Earth, these three take place on Venus, but only on Earth we have the added of CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, which are in refrigerants and actually have been now banned, Freon, and are now banned in this country and are slowly being phased out around the world because they also deplete the ozone layer, which is actually, ozone depletion does not affect global warming. The only connection really is that CFCs do both.
Do both. They deplete the
ozone. Yep, and act as a greenhouse gas.
Okay. Yep. You said water in the form of a cloud would reflect it, hence it would not create the greenhouse effect as a cloud, but under what conditions would it be?
As vapor. In the room, we have relative humidity.
Got it.
And so just when it's the invisible vapor, mm-hmm. It does actually trap heat.
It traps it.
Yeah. And actually it depends on the level of the cloud and what type of a cloud. A high cloud will reflect, a low cloud will insulate.
Okay.
So that's why, you know, on a cloudy night, it doesn't cool off as fast as on a clear night. But if they're really high clouds during the day, then that reflects the heat.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're starting to get into this, a lot of the complicating factors that makes it so hard to figure out what exactly will happen, and thus we have the controversy. So these are your basic, what we call greenhouse gases. Yeah.
Now, aerosols, are they CFC or anything like that?
Aerosols used to be, the propellants used to be CFCs, and that was actually banned a number of years ago, even before the Montreal Protocol. That was banned in the late 70s, I think. It's just kind of persisted as a myth that aerosols have CFCs in them. But yeah, now CFCs are banned in this country. Some other countries are still allowed to produce them with the Montreal Protocol, and some of those are smuggled into the country. But CFCs are banned. Yeah. And now actually we have HCFCs, which is when you have your refrigerator or your air conditioner retrofitted for the new coolants. Those are not ozone depleting, but they are still greenhouse gases. So when those release, they still act as a greenhouse gas. So I'll add those up here, and they're called usually HCFCs, and those are the new refrigerants.
So the depleting of the ozone really isn't a factor here.
Yeah, because that deals with ultraviolet radiation. Now, ozone depletion is much more threatening to life than the greenhouse effect. If we lost our ozone layer, ultraviolet radiation would inundate the Earth, and life would not be able to exist except under the ground and under the seas. Before there was an ozone layer, before we had an oxygen-rich atmosphere, 3.5 billion years ago, life only existed in the sea far enough below the surface that ultraviolet was blocked by the water. Mm. And it was only the development of an ozone layer through natural processes that allowed life to go up onto the land.
Are there other chemicals that are other things that destroy ozone other than the CFCs?
As far as we know right now, we've only determined that CFCs, and it's the chlorine, chlorofluorocarbons. So there's a chlorine in here. The interesting thing about CFCs is they were a wonderful chemical. You can pour CFC on your hand, you can breathe it in, it doesn't hurt you. It's a very inert, stable compound. It doesn't break down to anything. But because it doesn't break down, it never goes anywhere, and slowly, they're kind of heavy, but because we have great convection currents, like in thunderstorms, you can have a molecule of air right here outside, and in a thunderstorm, a minute later, it can be 5 miles up. We have these molecules going up, and once they get high, ultraviolet radiation can hit them, split apart the chlorine. Chlorine now acts as a free radical, if you've heard that term, which then goes and basically one chlorine can destroy hundreds of thousands of ozone molecules. Mm-hmm. So actually the ozone depletion that we're seeing right now is probably from CFCs released in the early 80s, because the ones we released in the late 80s haven't gotten there yet. And the ones that we released in the 70s are still working to destroy the ozone. So we haven't seen the worst of the ozone yet. Depletion yet, which is kind of a scary thing, because that's truly could be an environmental catastrophe if we lost our ozone layer.
So what does ultraviolet do besides give cancer to us?
Well, ultraviolet is since it's a higher radiation, you have light, and then you have ultraviolet, because violet is the highest light. If you know, Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, colors of the rainbow. Ultraviolet, and then you have X-ray, and then you have gamma ray. Gamma ray, very destructive of cells. X-rays are fairly destructive of cells. And ultraviolet it can't pass through you, but it can get into your skin. And what all three of these radiations can do is they break up molecules. They are strong enough to, if there's a molecule, they just, wherever they pass, will break the bond between those molecules. Now, if it passes through the nuclei of your cell and breaks up the DNA, it can split apart your DNA, which then can make mutations arise. And if it hits the right part, scrambles the DNA in the right way, those cells become cancerous. Because the DNA, being the blueprint of our cell, the control mechanism, tells the cell how to behave. When that message is messed up, then they behave crazy and they just go out of control and become cancerous. And it does that to any cell. They have done studies and they've seen that crop or soybeans, corn, if you increase ultraviolet radiation by 10%, you decrease crop yields by about 70%. So one of the things, you know, people often think, well, it means we're going to have to put on sunscreen. Unfortunately, we can't put on sunscreen on every living thing on the planet. Just as you don't want to have too many x-rays in your life, you don't want to have too much UV either. And it affects any living thing that's exposed to it, you know, any cells. So that's why it's such a dramatic thing. Now, fortunately, the countries of the world actually acted even before there was conclusive scientific evidence. And after they passed the Montreal Protocol or were in the process of it, then the hole over Antarctica appeared, which was actually, the process was a lot worse than what scientists had predicted. But fortunately, we're making steps there. So there is hope. We can do some things, and we don't know how far it's going to go before we turn around. But
and there's no such thing as a repair of the ozone.
Not that we know of. It's sort of ironic that ozone is a pollutant as well. Your car produces ozone, and if you breathe ozone, it destroys your lungs. Ozone is one of the primary constituents of smog. One of the reasons that asthma is so prevalent among children today in the cities is ground-level ozone. So, you know, if we could put that up in the atmosphere, that'd be great. But it's kind of like emptying Lake Superior into the Atlantic using a teaspoon and walking. Because it's, you know, we're talking about global scale.
Slower on that a little bit. If the ozone is created here as a pollutant, it doesn't go up as the chlorophyll or carbons go up? I mean,
it would, yes. The thing about ozone, the way ozone is created, and it's actually destroyed naturally too, is through ultraviolet radiation. You have oxygen is O2, the oxygen we breathe. It's two molecules of oxygen bonded together. And what UV does is it breaks apart molecules. So it'll split an oxygen into O1 and O1, two oxygen atoms. And if there's another, sometimes they go back right together as O2. But if they bump into another O2, it will grab onto them. Oxygen cannot be by itself. It's incredibly reactive. So what happens, you have one oxygen here, and then you have oxygen bonded to oxygen. If they bump into each other, then they become O3, like that. Well, actually, it's like that, which is ozone, O3. And that is what helps protect us from ultraviolet. And the reason where ultraviolet, on its way breaking up molecules, just keeps going and hits the Earth, this actually will absorb the energy of the ultraviolet ray when it's broken up. So ozone is constantly broken and put right back together by UV light. The process, the natural process, has been that more ozone has formed over the last 3.5 billion years since the arise of photosynthesis and oxygen atmosphere. More has developed than has been destroyed, so we have ozone in the atmosphere. It's very, very small amount. It's very spread out. Some would, from our ground level, go up just like CFCs go up, where we may, you know, have maybe, let's say we have 100 molecules of O3 go up from a car, and we have 10 molecules of CFC go up. Well, each one molecule of CFC will destroy 100,000 ozone, so that the net effect is a loss of ozone.
So if you take Los Angeles, and you take the pollutants that are there, and you live in Los Angeles, would you get less ultraviolet as a person living there in that polluted environment because it's full of ozone, which would absorb the ultraviolet?
You know, that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. If ground level ozone in a concentrated form with the inversion there can't absorb as well as stratospheric ozone, and I don't know. That's an interesting question. Okay. Well, I'm going to steer us back to global warming. Just one quick question.
Sure.
Before, in the Midwest, before a thunderstorm, there was that real sweet smell that was always tagged as being ozone. Is that something that, a byproduct of a thunderstorm, or?
Yeah, ozone is formed from lightning, because lightning has the power to split oxygen molecules and make O3.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here we have, back to greenhouse gases. These greenhouse gases then absorb this infrared that comes in, is sort of blocked by these and absorbed. So these molecules actually take in the heat and radiate that heat back to the surface of the Earth, just like a blanket does. That's why Venus is so warm. It's because of its greenhouse effect. The primary gas in Venus's atmosphere is carbon dioxide. And that's why it's so warm. It's because it has a very heavy blanket of carbon dioxide, really well insulated. Now, it's interesting, and by the way, Mars has very little atmosphere. The reason being is that it's a smaller planet, so it doesn't have the gravitational pull to hold on. So everything that it had just kind of boiled away into space. But Earth and Venus, being almost the same size as each other, haven't been able to hold on to their atmosphere, but they formed in many different ways. This being primarily carbon dioxide, and ours being primarily nitrogen. So let's talk a little bit about Earth's atmosphere, what it's made up of, and just how much carbon dioxide do we have on our planet. Anybody know the percentages of atmosphere, or atmosphere?
A fifth oxygen.
It is, yeah. It's about a fifth oxygen. Let's see, I've even got the... First of all, our largest component is nitrogen. And nitrogen is inert. We breathe it in, we breathe it out. It does not really affect us. And nitrogen is a component of fertilizer, but atmospheric nitrogen doesn't do any good for that. The only nitrogen the plants can use is in other forms, nitrites, nitrates, ammonia. Atmospheric nitrogen is very stable, so we call it inert. It doesn't really affect anything until it's turned into something else. 78.1%. So almost 80% of our atmosphere is nitrogen. So when you breathe in, you breathe nitrogen. Next is O2, and notice these are all together. They don't exist just one atom. It's always with another atom. They buddy up. And this is one-fifth. 20.9% or almost 21% oxygen. And that's enough for us to live just fine. And then next is argon. If you remember your study of chemistry, the noble gases, argon is one of the noble gases, doesn't react with anybody or anything. And that is less than 1% at 0.93%. And it's only now that we get the carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is 0.035%. Very, very small amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
3/10.
Yeah. And yet, this amount, 0.3%, which is
3%.
Yeah. This small amount, coupled with some methane. Methane being CH4, methane, at about 0.00017%, and then our levels of CFCs are even lower than that, are just negligible. These have a profound effect as a blanket. It's an incredibly, when you look at the global scale, even this small amount can have a big greenhouse effect, and that's why Earth is nice and you know, a nice livable planet. If we did not have this level of carbon dioxide and methane, we would be a frozen planet. Mm-hmm. So sort of an interesting thing there, mm-hmm. This small amount. Considering this, that's why people develop the idea that if you increase this, it's like adding more blankets to your bed, Earth would probably get warmer. We can look at Venus, Well, Venus is really hot. Well, it's got a lot of carbon dioxide. Earth, we know, is sort of warm because of a very tiny amount of carbon dioxide. Well, would the Earth increase its temperature if we raised our levels of gases? Well, you know, people said, well, maybe so. And actually, the first guy to present this was a guy by the name of Arrhenius. He was a Swedish scientist. He also came up with the difference between acids and bases. If you're interested in that. And he came up with it in the 1800s, and nobody paid any attention. By the way, he passed his PhD, his thesis, lowest possible passing grade. His doctoral thesis committee thought it was all bunk. He later won the Nobel Prize for his work. And that was actually not to do with greenhouse effect. It had to do with ionic compounds. He was the first one to determine how ionic things work.
Now, carbon dioxide is broken down, though, right?
No. Well,
don't plants utilize it?
Plants do utilize it, yes. They don't break. What they do is they reincorporate it into their structure. We are made up of carbon,
right.
Oxygen, water, primarily. We are carbohydrates and water.
Don't they release the carbon or break off the carbon and release the oxygen?
They do. Plants, well, we have lots of different ways that carbon is incorporated back into out of the atmosphere, the whole carbon cycle. And one is with plants. So if you have a tree or any plant, this plant will breathe in carbon dioxide from the air, and it will get water from the soil. It actually gets its oxygen that it puts out, that we breathe, from the water. It doesn't actually get it from the carbon dioxide. This actually goes into the sugars that it makes, which are what we then eat, the basis of the food chain. The carbohydrates, the fats, the proteins that plants make, or animals make by eating plants, are all from the carbon dioxide. So whenever you eat, you ate carbon that used to be in the atmosphere, Christ, carbon dioxide. Now the thing about the carbon cycle is, as long as this tree is alive or intact, a lot of this carbon is stored within its structure. Talk about the mass of a tree is mostly carbon and water. That's what it's made up of. That's what you're made up of. So I'm about 175 pounds. That's 175 pounds of water and carbon and nitrogen and sulfur and some other things. But if we cut this tree down and burn it, then all that carbon is suddenly released. If we cut it down and just let it decompose, the bacteria eat it and release the carbon, either as carbon dioxide or methane, depending on whether they had oxygen. So it's a cycle. It always, you know, what goes in will come out. What goes in will come out. Now, one of the reasons that today's, we actually have less atmospheric carbon than, say, in the dinosaurs' time. Because a lot of the old plants that died went out into the ground and became fossil fuels. Coal, oil, natural gas. So you have all these things that used to be alive, instead of being completely decayed and their carbon liberated back to the atmosphere, it's trapped in the earth. So hundreds of millions of years of actually taking carbon from the air, putting it in the earth in storage.
Like a vault.
Like a vault. So every bit of coal, natural gas, and oil represents carbon dioxide that used to be in the atmosphere that's now trapped as a vault. So the concern is, what happens when a species comes and takes what took 300 or 400 million years to put in and release it in 200 years? That's the concern. Some other parts of the carbon cycle that are important to note, the oceans. Gases will dissolve in water, in liquids. And carbon dioxide, just like oxygen, will dissolve. The more gas you have in the outside, the more it can dissolve into the liquid. So the way they get carbonated beverages is they have high pressure carbon dioxide in your Coca-Cola to make sure it goes into the Coca-Cola. The other thing they do is they keep it cool. Cool liquids dissolve more gases.
That's why trout like cold water, because it has higher oxygen. It also would have higher carbon dioxide in it, because any gas would be dissolved more highly. The cooler the oceans, the more carbon dioxide they can absorb. The more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the more they absorb. One of the controversies is what happens as we warm them up, will they then begin to release more carbon dioxide? Don't know. So the carbon cycle is, it's not static. It definitely changes. Plants absorb it, the oceans absorb it. When we breathe out, we're breathing out carbon that we got from a plant that at one time breathed in. So it is, it's definitely dynamic. Definitely dynamic. So the problem now arises is all of this carbon that was trapped in the earth from the dinosaurs' time. And by the way, when the dinosaurs were around, you were lucky if it snowed in the Arctic Circle. It was much warmer then. So the earth has definitely gone under climate change. That's a natural, very natural process. During a few hundred million years ago, the earth was much warmer. And it did have a lot higher incidence of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Okay, so humans come along, we dig up coal, we dig up oil, we dig up natural gas, which all represents carbon trapped. And we burn that. Whenever you burn anything, you release carbon. And if you're curious about the basic chemical formula, this is what we do in our cell. This is sugar, this is glucose, Gatorade, C6H12O6. Everything a plant produces is this and then some. So you just keep adding on more atoms to that and you make everything else that we ever eat. Fats, proteins, carbohydrates, whatever, this and then some. You add oxygen to it, and you can burn it, and you can release energy, which is what our cells do. You release carbon dioxide, which is what we breathe out, and you also release water vapor. Kangaroo rat uses this exclusively to get his water. Kangaroo rat lives in the Southwest desert, never drinks. Gets all of its water from very efficiently using the breakdown of the things it eats. Kind of an interesting thing, because there is water vapor released. So that's your basic respiration formula, and it's also whenever you burn a tree or burn anything, that's what you get. So you always have carbon dioxide and water. If you have the most efficient internal combustion engine that has zero pollution means it only produces CO2 and water. So if you get the cleanest burning gasoline and the cleanest burning engine, you only produce CO2 and water. Now we don't have the cleanest, we also produce, you know, nitrogen and sulfur, which make acid rain and ground level ozone and all these other things that are bad pollutants.
And that would go for the proposed hydrogen cell vehicles?
No. Because hydrogen cells take water, break that into hydrogen and oxygen, burn it, and produce water. So there's no, all you're doing there, whenever you burn hydrogen,
right,
you put it with oxygen and you get water. So that's it produces water.
Net sum gain, I guess you'd call it, or zero sum gain, or whatever.
It depends on how do you get the hydrogen? You've got to somehow get the hydrogen liberated, which takes energy, but you can use different chemical reactions to do that, and then you can burn it. Hydrogen's a great one of the experiments I do with my students is you trap some hydrogen with a reaction, and put a flame to the balloon and big. Very dramatic. It's the Hindenburg. Guess what? The Hindenburg was hydrogen in. But the only pollution from that explosion was water and a lot of heat and a lot of dead people. That's a tragic result. But that's why hydrogen cells are considered a good alternative, because they do not produce carbon dioxide. Good question. Okay. So whenever we burn
anything that was organic came from something living, a tree, wood, fossil fuels, oil or coal, gasoline in our car, we will release carbon dioxide. Now, if we look at when humans started to do this, which was basically the 1800s, and all you students of history know what happened in the early 1800s. What revolution?
The Industrial Revolution.
People moved from their farms to the cities and started working in factories. And factories used coal to fuel. And let's see where I have my notes on the, here we go. Okay, if you look at about 1700 or 1800, late 1700s, we'll say, there was about 0.0275% of was carbon dioxide, and then today, about 0.035% of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide. So, a significant increase from, it's almost a third increase over the last couple hundred years. Now, how do we know that? We can look at carbon dioxide levels by looking at ice, going deep into glaciers, and there's little bubbles when the ice formed, and they sample that bubble, and they figure, well, that glacier was formed 100 years ago, that layer, the bubble there has this atmospheric competition, and they keep going on down. Kind of an interesting thing. I don't know if you can see this little chart here. I'll pass this around. It shows three different glaciers or areas, and it shows carbon dioxide concentration, and it's pretty much static until you hit almost 1800, and then it's exponential.
So if you go back to the last glaciation 12,000 years ago for our area here, there are glaciers that still exist that would have that as their base, I would assume, in that Arctic?
Well, the way glaciers work is they flow from their base.
So therefore, you really would have a hard time.
You can't go back indefinitely.
You can't.
I think we can go back maybe 1,000 or 2,000 years that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we have to use other means, which are, then we're getting into more extrapolation. You know, what was the content, what are the fossils in the sea, you know, what is their composition, how many were there, so you have to, in going further back, you know, the predictions become less definite because you're extrapolating a lot.
Right, the information isn't as direct as off of the glacier.
Yeah.
Well, maybe global warming is good.
Well, and some people have argued that. Arrhenius, the first guy, that Swedish guy who said we're going to have global warming, says it's going to be great, you know, and not going to, he would live in Sweden.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. It's not going to be so darn cold here. Yeah. Maybe he had relatives in Minnesota, I don't know. but at any rate, what we have looked at is that, yes, we have increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We've also increased the amount of methane in the atmosphere because we have much more landfills. Landfills are anaerobic. They produce methane. We have a lot more cows. We have a lot more rice paddies because we have more people. All those things produce more methane. So we are producing more greenhouse gases. We have CFCs. So we know that there are more greenhouse gases. Now, will that increase the temperature of the planet? There's debate on that. Because of some of the following reasons. First of all, let's look at the Earth system. The Earth is really big. And even though we can travel over the world, it's still really big. The atmosphere is even bigger. And the concentrations and the movement of gases and weather patterns and climate and natural cycles are really beyond our ability to understand. We only have a small glimpse, and obviously we cannot predict the weather. We have a little better idea of predicting climate than weather, because climate, where weather goes like this, climate goes more like this. Okay, it's a little more stable because it's over a greater period of time. But we still don't have, you know, obviously we're not
we don't know all the answers. We don't have everything. There's too much chaos involved. When we look at global climate, we have seen that it used to be a lot warmer and it used to be colder. 10,000 years ago, this was all glacier. You know, the glaciers that formed the Great Lakes and all the lakes of Minnesota and everything happened about 10,000 years ago. So the northern half of this country was covered in an ice layer up to a mile thick 10,000 years ago. Now the Earth has since warmed about 5 degrees C. It only took about 5 degrees C average, so that we're in our temperate climate right now. Now, some people have shown that it looks like we are in an interglacial period, that interglacial periods have lasted about 10 to 15,000 years, and then another ice age happens. And then there's another interglacial period and another ice age. And that for the last 100,000 years or so, that's what it seems to be happening. Go back 100 million years ago and we had very tropical climate everywhere. It's much warmer. So Earth's climate changes. That's not a big deal. If you look at the grand scheme, life has existed. Some things died, some new things live. That's a natural process. The concern comes in, what happens when humans start to change it, and what happens when we change it really, really fast? What happens when we dump in all this carbon dioxide that took 400 million years to trap, and we dump it out into the atmosphere in 200 or 300 years? What happens then? Does that accelerate change faster than the Earth systems can balance? Maybe so. We all know that there's, you kind of mentioned, you know, what's the junk science and what's the hard science. There's a lot of hard science that people have looked at, and some people have picked out from that hard science that, yes, global warming is occurring. And some people have said, no, it's not occurring from that hard science. Because even with the hard science, there's a lot of interpretation. If we look at what most scientists, what most climatologists and most meteorologists, by looking at the big picture, they would say that yes, global warming makes sense. That if you look at our computer models and you put in everything we can, if you account for albedo from the ice reflection and you account for the increase of carbon dioxide and you account for the normal cycles of the Earth, then yes, global warming will be happening. And other people say, no, you're not looking at it right because you're missing this one part here. And one of that part that makes a big controversy is the effect of water. As the planet warms, you can have more water vapor in the air. On a hot day, it's a lot easier to get more water vapor in the air than on a cold day. And that's why our houses are so dry in the wintertime. Water vapor in the outside is very low. You bring it in, you heat it up, and now you're very dry. So warm air can hold more water vapor. So we would increase water vapor if the global climate increased temperature. Does that mean that water vapor acts as a greenhouse gas, and then you have
an accelerating effect?
Yeah, snowball effect. Or does it mean that those are going to form high clouds? Since you have more water vapor, you're going to have more clouds and a higher albedo effect. Or do you have more low clouds and as a blanket effect, an insulating effect? Don't know. That's something that, you know, our best computer models, I mean, that's where you get into chaos theory. It's doubtful whether there's really a way to predict what would happen. So that's some of the debate right there. Some of the other debate is with particulate matter. As we burn more coal and oil, we also put out sulfur and nitrogen. We put out little pieces of dust. Well, they reflect light. They also form nuclei for clouds to form. So that would help clouds form more. So that would reduce temperature. But some people say, well, those are heavier and they fall out while carbon dioxide does not. So they get washed out of the sky, so they don't have
a long-lasting effect as high carbon dioxide would. So even with the hard science, you've got some controversy, which is healthy. That's what science is all about, is trying to, you know, debate, you know, what really is happening. I show a video to my students, or I did this last year, that was made in the 80s, and it was predicting all these things that might happen. And then, with global warming, and then I showed this poster of effects of global warming around the world, put together by the National Science Foundation and World Wildlife Fund and National Defense Fund and UNEA Concerned Scientists. And all those things that the video talked about might happen, it showed in the world where they are indeed happening today. There's a consensus among scientists that the Earth's oceans are warmer than they were. They are warming. And there is a consensus that glaciers are indeed melting. Here, I stole this from the Portal Museum, and I will give it back. Postcard of Lyman Glacier, 1907, and then here it is in 1988. So you can see, look at the peak in the back, and look at the glacier. And the glacier had been there from the Ice Age. That's what's left over from the Ice Age. To get an idea of, it's not really there anymore. If you go to Lyman, there's a snowfield, but there's not really a glacier left. Hmm. But 93 years ago, it covered the lake. You could barely see the lake because of the glacier there. In the last 10 years, glaciers have really started to break up. There's in the latest Christian Science Monitor, it talks about the thinning of the Greenland ice sheet, noticed by NASA satellites. And where you had an ice shelf off of Antarctica, the size of like Texas has broken off and is now floating, and slowly melting as it floats around. So there definitely glaciers are melting, and ice fields are melting. The Earth's oceans are a couple degrees warmer than they were 100 years ago. The Earth's temperature is a little bit, the oceans can warm faster than the atmosphere can warm. But the average temperature, you know, the last decade was the hottest decade on record. Mm-hmm. Now, a hot decade does not global warming make, but global warming does make a hot decade. So, are these signs of global warming, or are these red herrings? Some people are saying these are natural cycles, that the Earth is in a warming period, and then we will go back to a cooling period. Earth has done that. It's warmed and it's cooled. It's warmed and it's cooled. Or is this actually anthropogenic, human-caused climate change? Is it because our carbon dioxide and methane has increased? You know, we've increased the blanket, and therefore we've increased global warming.
But it seems like the thing about that argument that's disturbing, and it seems like it's a stall, is that they don't know the one. In other words, there's a speculation on whether or not there's a global cycle. However accurate that speculation may be, or understandable, or even inevitable, it's still speculation. But there's no speculation on the fact that that chart you showed there, the curve of carbon dioxide emissions is dramatically increasing. And like you said, you've got how many million years of carbon-based fossil fuels in the ground that are being dug up and pumped into the environment. There is no speculation about that. So it seems like if you have to err, you have to make a decision in the midst of the controversy. The overwhelming evidence is, you know, carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, and it is being dumped at an accelerating rate into the environment, and therefore it has to be have an effect. Mm-hmm. You know, there may be both things going on, but there can be no doubt about the latter, you know.
Right. So and that is the consensus of most scientists. One vocal opponent of the global warming theory is Fred Sanger, and he's actually mentioned in the article there.
An opponent?
Opponent, yeah. And he is he's a well-known, well-respected scientist. And I've read part of his book,
hot talk cold science. And what I have found is that it's, instead of saying, let's look at the broad picture and say, okay, how do these theories match? It's sort of like, well, this piece of data doesn't work, and this piece of data doesn't work. And I found it difficult to read just because he was like, well, these satellite images are actually not right. And these, you know, it's more the opponents have been, well, this little piece of your theory is not right. And I would, you know, challenge that, well, we know that carbon dioxide is a global warming gas. It's a greenhouse gas. We know we are increasing it. We know that Venus is so hot because it has a runaway greenhouse effect, basically, because of its high amounts of both water vapor and carbon dioxide. It follows, therefore, that Earth would also experience that. But the debate is because it is uncertain. It will never be determined. You can't have a model, you know, you don't have a control planet. We can't have another Earth somewhere where we don't raise the temperature, I mean, we don't raise the carbon dioxide and see what happens. You know, we can't have an ideal experiment here. It's all open to interpretation.
Yeah, I suppose there's also the conjecture that there's no telling what the Earth, if you just subtracted all the carbon dioxide that's being dumped into the environment right now, just took it out of the picture, stopped it today, maybe the Earth is cooling. I mean, and that this is a competent, you know, I can see the way that debate would go, you know.
Well, in 300 years ago, we had a little ice age.
Right. Well, wasn't there a mini ice age in the late 1800s, too? I remember it was in the 1870s to 1880s. Some of these glaciers, these local glaciers around where I live, started expanding again.
That's right. I believe that's right.
Yeah.
You know, some people are saying, well, we're due for another ice age. Maybe this will forestall it. You know, that would be a good thing. Now, global warming will not destroy life on the planet. It will not, in 10,000 years, it won't be a big blip. The reason it's a problem for us right now is we are short-lived species. Many people do have real estate on the coast.
That's the issue.
We have great soils in the Midwest, and we happen to have a climate that is still favorable to farming. One of the predictions is that the breadbasket would move north to Siberia and more into Canada.
BC would be a
great farming area.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the soils don't have that, you know, the soils of the Midwest produce over thousands of years of growing and dying and growing and dying. And you look at the soil here, the climate may be favorable, but the soils are all rocky and dusty. They don't have that nice organic. Economically, you know, it's going to be devastating. You know, here the United States is a great producer of grain. What happens if all that collapses, you know? The other change that, you know, we've sort of set up our whole environmental protection under current conditions. Our national parks have definite boundaries. If the climate changes and all those forests die in that national park, that's a real bummer, because then they, you know, if you want to go, those trees or those forests start to spring up in the middle of a city, that's not going to work. Or in the middle of an agricultural field, you know. With our island mentality of preservation, that doesn't work when the climate changes. The other thing that doesn't work is, you know, our real estate mentality of these are particular boundaries when the climate changes, because we set it up among these specific things. Some of the other kind of harbingers of problems, coral reefs around the world are dying. And the way coral works, coral is a symbiotic relationship between an animal and algae, which is a plant. The algae lives inside of it and produces the food for the coral, and the coral provides a nice house. Well, we're experiencing coral bleaching, which means that the algae either dies or is expelled from the coral because the coral gets too warm. Coral, you know, water doesn't change all that fast, but a 2 to 3 degree change in water temperature is a big change for somebody that lives in the ocean. And so these corals are all of a sudden losing their algae and then starving to death. Well, coral reefs
About a quarter of the known marine species live around coral reefs. And most of our fish that we eat come from coral reefs. So as coral reefs die, what does that do to our food stocks? And just also the biodiversity of the planet. Disease is spreading more. A lot of disease is spread by insects. And those insects need a particular climate to live in. Malaria is spreading. Malaria is the number one disease in the world. About a billion people have malaria. That's a sixth of the population. Yeah, because we're about 6 billion. And malaria is spreading because the mosquitoes are now moving up higher up the mountains, and they're moving more north and more south because of the warming. And other diseases are spreading that way too. There's concern about, you had mentioned like crazy weather. Well, some weather, storms are the product of warm air. Hurricanes, and you have more thunderstorms in the summer than you do in the winter, because you have more energy. That more thermal energy creates more dynamic weather patterns. So there's a concern we're going to have more drastic weather. Now, it doesn't mean that for every increase in storms, that's because of global warming. I mean, there again, it's not a direct effect. Although it might be. We just don't know. So there are some things that it's definitely going to be, if global warming is indeed occurring, and if it does indeed happen, there will be definite change. I know there's an island nation that's not too far above sea level and is concerned about its existence. If the oceans rise, as they're predicted to rise, they're going to be gone because they'll be underwater.
It seems politically really scary too, because those agrarian societies where there's a climate change, masses of people, it just makes the powerful more powerful and the poor less powerful, because the poor can't afford to shift with climate changes, and those people who access, like we do, who access resources from all over the world, will continue to wield that same sort of power. Certain people will wield that same power and survive global warming really nicely, but people who have no power will be powerless against changes and shifts in climates. I mean, think about masses of people in Africa or Latin America, who live on the climate. They live on what they produce. They live close to their food source. So global warming changes that, and then their food chain changes. So it's really scary in terms of what can happen to groups of people inhabiting the planet. It's not so bad for us. We'll just pull from some other thing. We'll move around or something. But, probably 3/4 of the people on Earth can't do that.
No, I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point.
It's a good point, but there's also a counterpoint. Our society, when it falls, will fall much harder than that, because we're not survival.
But if you think, how far, like let's say there's some sort of disaster, like suddenly, some big, climatic change. I mean, most of us can get in our utility vehicles. We've got so many resources to bring to bear as sort of first world people to try to circumvent disaster for ourselves and our families. But if you live in a hut that you built out of something in, some rural area of Africa, and suddenly your food sources start to move away, to die, to no longer exist because of changes in the climate, how much power do you have to bring to bear? You fall really quickly. Maybe you don't fall very far, but your children start to starve.
But there's another counterpoint.
Oh, good.
If you take Los Angeles, if you have any disruption in the water flow there, or really climatic changes that change those patterns, you have millions of people that will be in conflict. If you have an African society, they are more mobile. They know how to live off the land. They know how to eat grubs. They know how to eat. The indigenous will probably survive better. And so that when you talk about the power structures, those are interim. When you're talking about what will be more of the overall, it could be much more drastic here. We will fall much harder and faster. We do not know how to survive.
You're right, because we have so much infrastructure between.
We have nothing. We will not survive.
But on the other hand, people who are politically powerful, quickly, can re-grab and rebuild that
a lot of people in urban areas that just live within the powerful culture.
That's the top structure up here. When I'm talking about, I don't know where you are, but I'm sitting here. And I will not survive because we will be killing each other for those reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where your real problem comes into play. And so in the long term, the indigenous will survive, and we will not.
Well, point taken, but nonetheless, it's going to be really hard on the social structure of the world for lots of different societies, if in fact there are two.